The year 2011 brought a variety of memorable stories, some exciting, some tragic, and some fun. I'm Susan Fogel-Masika. This week, we take a look at the news that made an impression on the journalists at swissinfo.ch. Something that intrigued me was the 40th anniversary of women's suffrage in Switzerland. To me, 40 years isn't such a long time, but leading ladies celebrated the milestone in style in Bern, among them the four female cabinet members. While I was there, I had the chance to chat with Elisabeth Kopp, Switzerland's first woman cabinet member. She told me she hoped that in another four decades, men would see women as equals. In related news, Jessica Dacey recalls a thought-provoking conference.
One of the stories that I covered that was the most inspiring for me this year was a conference that was hosted by the U.S. Embassy in Switzerland, and it was on the next 100 years of women's leadership. Rather than your typical kind of conference, this was really a think tank for people to share their ideas and their experiences about how they had come to be in these very successful positions. On the one hand, you had the American ambassador to Bern, a man, Donald Baer, who talked about his privileged background. Basically, he'd been a man who'd gone to one of the best schools, had been on all male company boards. And he said that this, in fact, was a tragedy. It was not something to brag about. We had a video message from the U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who was talking about a conference like this needing to be about connections and partnerships. The Swiss communications minister, Doris Leuthard, said that Switzerland, who after 40 years of giving women the vote, said they had joined the ranks of normality. One phrase that was really being bandied about the conference was that this so-called glass ceiling that we all know of is actually a thick layer of men. And this really rung true with a lot of women who were there that day. And the other thing was that really there was an idea that leadership styles need to change, and that the one that we're looking forward to in the next 100 years is one of collaboration and listening. And this is really a more feminine style of leadership.
Power was another topic making headlines this year, and not only in the political or business sense, as Dale Bechtel points out.
In mid-February last year, I was riding around Lake Wohlen, just outside of Bern, with my wife and a friend of hers. And we were passing the nuclear power station, Mühleberg. This was on a Saturday. The following day, we were also voting on whether to replace it in a few years' time with a new nuclear power station. What we didn't know was there was a photographer there from the Keystone News Agency. He saw us and told us, "Stop! I want to take your picture. I need, you know, a different angle or a different take on the Mühleberg power station." So he asked us to ride back and forth in front of his camera a few times so we could take our picture. The next day, the Swiss came out in favor of replacing the nuclear power station Mühleberg with a new one. What they didn't know was that only a few weeks later, along comes Fukushima, and a few weeks after that, the Swiss government comes out and says, "We're going to decommission all nuclear power stations in Switzerland starting from 2019. And that vote was for naught.
The Swiss authorities also had to put the brakes on the Swiss franc. Matthew Allen tells us more about that.
One of the biggest ongoing stories was the strength of the Swiss franc, which has been going through the roof for a couple of years now and has peaked in August by nearly reaching parity with the euro, which would have spelt absolute disaster for Swiss exporters and for the Swiss tourism industry. At this point, the end of August, beginning of September, the Swiss National Bank decided they had to act, they had to try and do something, and they set a ceiling on the exchange rate with the euro at 1.20 francs and said very defiantly they weren't going to allow the franc to appreciate any further than this mark. And it sort of presented a bit of a watershed because the Swiss National Bank had tried to intervene in other ways before and had failed completely, and they just had to put their foot down. And so far it's worked. There were a few skeptics who thought that the speculators would come in and wreck the plans and force all sorts of problems upon the bank and exporters and so on, but it's held up so far. The issue wasn't really to try and make everything better because Switzerland can't. Switzerland's reliant on the outside world, the outside economy, especially the Eurozone. And if things are going wrong in the Eurozone, it's just going to reflect badly on Switzerland. There's nothing they can do. But it's just a sort of a safety measure, a safety valve to try and prevent things getting too bad, which would lead to high unemployment and serious economic problems. So we're in a position where we're waiting and seeing, but that really was quite a serious measure.
And how do you predict that this story will develop in 2012?
Well, it doesn't look very good for 2012 because the Eurozone is still in dire straits. The US economy is picking up a little, but not very much. So you would expect Switzerland's economy to suffer accordingly. The big question is it going to go down to the street level? Is it going to affect the common man and woman in Switzerland, i.e. with unemployment, jobs being lost, people without a job? This is going to be the big issue to look for, how many people are going to lose their jobs as a result.
Some international leaders lost their jobs in 2011, partly due to a lack of humility, as Julia Slater explains.
Looking back on the year, I think there's been a very interesting theme that's dominated it: arrogance. It first struck me in February when demonstrators in Cairo in Tahrir Square were fully expecting Mubarak to make a speech telling them that he was going to go. And instead of doing that, he said he was reorganising and he would do this, he would do that. He'd lost the plot. He didn't realise what the people wanted. And I went home that evening thinking, that man's a goner. He'd be strung up from a lamppost in the morning. In actual fact, the military took over and pushed him out, and he survived. Then, a few weeks later, in Libya, we had Saif al-Islam Gaddafi addressing the people on television, jabbing his fingers, threatening them. And again, I thought, that's something you can't do. You simply don't understand what the people are trying to say to you. And if you behave like that, you've had it. And in fact, the next day I spoke to a doctor who was working in Benghazi, who told me that he'd returned from years and years spent abroad because he'd believed the promises of Saif al-Islam that things in Libya were going to change. And he said to me, when we saw the way that that man was behaving on television, that was it. He'd torn it. We saw the same thing in Russia with the elections. Putin and Medvedev think they've sewn it all up. They're going to swap jobs next year and everyone will go along with them. The Russians have said, no, we're not. You get the impression that Putin simply doesn't really know how to handle it. Again, somebody who's lost the plot. And I would say that we've seen a very similar thing in Switzerland as well. Many people, and I must admit, I too, expected the People's Party to do extremely well, carried along on a wave of popular enthusiasm. And then suddenly they didn't do as well as they expected in the elections. And their reaction has been really not understanding that they've done something wrong, not being able to accept it. Something else perhaps is not quite in the same league, but the recent changes in the railway, where from now, if you get on a train without having been able to buy a ticket, you can't get it from the conductor and you'll face a 90-franc fine. Are you going to miss your train and wait for a whole hour because you couldn't get to the ticket machine in time, because the ticket machine wasn't working, because there was someone in front of you in the queue who couldn't get the ticket machine to work? And you think, are they really in touch with how things work for ordinary people? So that's been the watchword for me this year: arrogance.
In sports news, an odd story from the French-speaking part of Switzerland still has Simon Bradley thinking.
The story that sticks most in my mind is that of Chechen entrepreneur Bulat Chagayev taking over the struggling Swiss First Division football club Neuchâtel Samax. Slightly unusual story perhaps, but here we have Chagayev, a former associate of ex-Chechen warlord and current president of Chechnya Ramzan Kadyrov, promising to take the debt-ridden Swiss side from the third from bottom of the league into the UEFA Champions League. Great news if you're a Zamax fan, because they were struggling, and 7 months later we are in a rather difficult situation with the club. When he took over the club in May, Chagayev cleared out a lot of the playing staff and probably did too much cleaning and raised lots of questions. He had financial problems with the city of Neuchâtel, who he rents the stadium from. And then the mood seemed to change at the club. We had a lot of sponsors being kicked out. He fired four coaches. He dismissed the entire administration staff. There were reports that he burst into the dressing room during a particularly poor performance with armed bodyguards, something which he denies. He cut ties with two of the biggest supporters groups, just alienating fans, and he's battling with all different authorities. As I say, it's been a real roller coaster ride. But I think both the club and its supporters have been rather naive. They dreamt of greatness, and maybe Chagayev himself was also naive, lacked a certain cultural awareness with the takeover, felt it was maybe easy to buy success.
Meanwhile, Thomas Stevens shares a story that continues to haunt him.
one that stuck in my mind, sticks in my mind, and actually still makes me come out in a cold sweat, was when Roger Federer lost in the semifinals of the US Open back in September, middle of September, to Novak Djokovic. It was a cracking match, as are all Federer's matches. And Federer, he went up two sets. Djokovic came back two sets all. And Federer played a blinder in the final set to have two match points on his own serve. He was serving 40-15. And he managed to throw away the game. He had two match points. I mean, every game with Federer, is always a rollercoaster of emotions. But this one, it was in the US, and so you had to get up in the middle of the night to watch it. And I went to bed immediately afterwards, and I was just tossing and turning, just replaying 40-15, 40-15 to myself. What he must have been, Federer must have gone to bed, and I don't know what he must have thought about jumping out the window, because Djokovic was the man to beat. And if he had beaten Djokovic, Djokovic did go on to win the tournament, and I think if Federer had beaten him, all he needed to do was ping down one good serve, and he would have won. That didn't happen, and Djokovic went on to win the title. So that was a real disappointment. I mean, not only for me, but Federer. I just don't know what Federer must have been thinking. However, the good news is he did end the year well. He won two tournaments in Basel and Paris, and he also won the year-end World Tour Finals, which is played between the best eight players in the world. And he won that. So he'll be going into 2012 full of confidence. And the Australian Open, which begins at the end of January, should be a great tournament. A lot of his opponents, including Djokovic, have slightly injured. Nadal, he's having a crisis of confidence. Murray's got a dodgy groin or something. And Federer's got good chances of winning his 17th Grand Slam. It should be a good tournament.
A big romance captured the attention of people all over the world, including Sophie Duhay.
Well, I think for me, the funniest story this year, or the most fun story to write this year, was something about Prince William and Kate Middleton getting married. You would think from the face of things that there wouldn't be a Swiss angle on this, but we managed to find one. William and Kate, of course, their first public kiss was snapped by the paparazzi on the slopes of Klosters. So that was our Swiss angle on the thing. And when we got into it, we were able to find quite a few Swiss and non-Swiss in Switzerland absolutely going nuts for the event. We spoke to the British cheese shop in Zurich, who said that they had loads of Swiss customers wanting to know about what was going on in the wedding, and so they'd found a cardboard cutout of the royal couple, and they'd made a 10-tier cake out of cheese to celebrate. And
there's a cheesecake for you.
It's a whole new take on the cheesecake, exactly. So an English bookshop in Zurich was also having quite a bit of interest from customers and people going nuts and wanting the day off and things like that. So it was quite fun. For me, this was a really fun story to look at, and also brought back, some of those childhood memories in Australia when we were allowed to stay up late to watch Charles and Di get married back in the day. You know, it was seen that most of the English department of Swiss Info was huddled around the telly to watch Wills and Kate tie the knot on the big day. And it was just something that really, was able to take our minds off, sometimes the more heavy news of politicians and wars and all sorts of other things that we are otherwise engaged with here.
And that's all we have time for this week. Thanks for listening. Visit us at swissinfo.ch for the latest news. I'm Susan Fogel-Masika.